Hey everyone, this is Shamira.
And this is Maria.
From What's Up Public Health. Today, we will be talking about the importance of voting and how having a little bit of knowledge on the impact of not just federal government, but local and state government can be powerful. Also on the podcast, we have a special guest, Brandon Freeman, joining us today. Stay tuned. Just a few friendly reminders before we begin the pod. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at WhatsUpPH or email us at WhatsUpPublicHealth@gmail.com. And if you like what you hear today on the pod, please leave us a 5-star rating wherever you listen to us.
So before we begin, we'd like to introduce our special guest, Brandon Freeman. Brandon holds a Master's of Science in Clinical Mental Health Counseling. His work experience runs the gamut of supporting adults, children, both adults and children with mental disabilities, both in a residential setting and a recreational setting. He's worked as an outpatient therapist with children and adults and provides intensive in-home counseling to children. He is passionate about politics and mental health. So, Brandon, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. It's a pleasure for being on here.
Oh, it's so great to have you with us today in the podcast.
So before getting started with our conversation on voting, I think it is a good idea that we give a breakdown of the political parties in the U.S., how voting occurs at the state level and federal level, and then dive into our conversation on why it's important to know this. Many think we only have two parties. We actually, in fact, have four different political parties in the U.S. And the first we'll touch on today is the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party is one of the two major contemporary political parties in the United States, along with its main rival, the Republican Party. And its heritage traces back to Thomas Jefferson and James Madison's Democratic-Republican Party. The modern-day Democratic Party was founded around 1828 by supporters of Andrew Jackson, making it the world's oldest active political party.
So within the Democratic Party, there are three factions that make up the Democratic Party. There's the moderate faction, the liberal progressives, and the radical far left. And the moderate faction of the Democratic Party, they tend to be more conservative on immigration, conservative in healthcare, conservative in terms of environmental regulations. And the most prominent current political figureheads in the moderate part of the Democratic Party would be like Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, and Barack Obama. The liberal and progressive faction of the Democratic Party, they support policies that are more geared to universal health care, gay marriage, diplomacy over military action, women's rights, cultural diversity, and free trade agreements such as NAFTA. And lastly, the last faction of the Democratic Party, there's the radical far left, which their policies are similar to liberals and progressives. They tend to be stronger support for universal health care, economic inequality, and stronger environmental regulations.
Perfect. And so moving into the Green Party of the United States is a grassroots national party where the party for we the people, the health of our planet, the future generations instead of the 1%. The party promotes green politics, specifically environmentalism, nonviolence, social justice, grassroots democracy, gender equality, LGBTQ rights, anti-war, anti-racism, and eco-socialism. Now, moving into the Libertarian Party is your representative in American politics. It is the only political organization that respects you as a unique and responsible individual. Their slogan is that they are the party of principle, because they stand firmly on our principles. Libertarians strongly oppose any government interference into their personal, family, and business decisions. Essentially, we believe all Americans should They believe all Americans should be free to live their lives and pursue their interests as they see fit, as long as they do no harm to one another. Founded in 1971, they've run many hundreds of candidates every election cycle. These candidates seek positions ranging from city council to president of the United States. Each of these candidates help to give liberty a voice.
Yeah, so the last one being the Republican. So the Republican Party by name, the Grand Old Party or GOAT in the United States, is one of the two major political parties, with the other one being the Democratic Party. And the Republican Party was founded in 1854. So the party first elected U.S. president was Abraham Lincoln, who soon took office in 1861, soon after the Republican Party was founded. This party was initially created to advocate for a free market economy that countered the Democratic Party's more leaning thoughts and support of slave labor. In recent history, the Republicans have been affiliated with reducing taxes to stimulate the economy, deregulation, and conservative social values.
Within the Republican Party, just like the Democratic Party, there's also those three factions. There's the moderate wing, the conservative wing, and the reactionary far-right wing. The moderate wing, they tend to focus more on balanced budgets, lower taxes, free trade, deregulation, some regulation and gun control, some support same-sex marriage. And there's the conservative wing, which they tend to look for preservations in institutions such as religion, government, and property rights. And then there's the reactionary far-right faction of the party, which they focus on incremental change, but to preserve what already exists.
Okay, so let's move into voting at the state level, and we'll begin with the Census 2020. The Census 2020, which has a due date of September 30th, 2020, so please don't forget to fill out your census, and you can find resources on 2020census.gov. So the 2020 Census counts every living person in the United States and in the five U.S. territories. The count is mandated by the Constitution and conducted by the U.S. Census Bureau, a nonpartisan government agency. The 2020 Census counts the population in the United States and the five territories. As I said before, those five territories includes Puerto Rico, American Samoa, the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands, Guam, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. Each home will receive an invitation to respond to a short questionnaire online by phone or by mail between March 12th to the 20th of 2020. It's also in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 2, which mandates that the country conduct a count of its population once every 10 years. The 2020 census will mark the 24th time that the country has counted its population since 1790. So, why is the census conducted? The census provides critical data that lawmakers, business owners, teachers, and many other use to provide daily services, products, and support for you and your community. Every year, billions of dollars in federal funding go to hospitals, fire departments, roads, schools, and other resources based on the census data, which is something I did not know. The results of the census also determine the number of seats each state will have in the U.S. House of Representatives, and they are used to draw congressional and state legislative districts.
So I think that one of the reasons, so the census, when looking at voting at a state level, the census is very important because that is what will determine your districts. And when you vote at a state level, you'll be voting for senators of certain districts. So you'll have your state senator of District 9, of District 15, and so forth. So depending on the number of the census, that will tell us how many people are in a certain area, which then will help create the lines of the districts, both for the U.S. federal government and both for the state government. And that then, those numbers from the census will also determine how much money that state and that district and that county will get. So when it comes to voting, the census really does drive a lot of the determining factors of how many districts you have, how many senators, how many House of Representatives you'll have, and senators, and so forth. When it comes to voting at a state level, now you have state level and you have local level. So at the state level, you vote for your U.S. senators. That's actually federal. When it comes to voting at a state level, you'll vote for your state senator of your district. So for example, me, I'm in District 9. So then I have to choose between the candidates, which one I like, and which are determined by popular vote, which we'll discuss later on. Now, when it comes to local level, there's also the local level, which includes voting for mayor. You vote for your sheriff of your, whether it's your county, you vote for the superintendent of the schools. You vote for many of the times the counter, the recorder. And there's actually some states can vary in what positions one has in the local government, but those are the most common ones, especially mayor. And I think a lot of the times we don't pay as much attention to this because it's not as big. It doesn't sound as big as a presidential election, but these people that are in the local and the state level are the ones creating the policies for your state. So that means how much money your schools will get at times, how what are the medical policies, expansion of Medicaid, for example. That was a state-based decision. While it could be done at the federal level, that one was done at the state. So you need to make sure that the people you're voting for at a state level are people you obviously vouch for in regards to how their policies are made. So the census ties into a lot of things. So make sure to fill out your census by September. But with that conversation, I think we can move on to voting at a federal level. So voting at a federal level, you vote for your U.S. senators, which each state has two, and you vote for your U.S. House of Representatives, which is determined by the census as well, which is determined by the population. So depending on the population depends how many U.S. state senators you will have, because the census will tell you how many districts you'll have. So it's sort of like a domino effect, if you really think about it. Now, there is one huge difference when it comes to the voting at a federal level and voting at a state level, and that's the Electoral College versus popular vote. So the Electoral College was established in Article 2, Section 1 of the U.S. Constitution. The Electoral College is the formal body which elects the president and vice president of the United States. No others. It's just they elect president and vice president. Each state has as many electors in the Electoral College as it has representatives and senators in the U.S. So every state has two senators plus how many U.S. representatives they have, which is dependent on the districts, which in theory is dependent on the census because the census helps draw the districts. And then the District of Columbia has three elector votes. So not every state has the same number of electors, and the number of electors does depend on the population number. And that's why you see big states like Arizona, California, and Texas have more electoral votes, because obviously those states are huge and have a higher population. Now, where it gets very tricky is that when the voters go to the polls in a presidential election, while you are voting on a popular vote, at the end of the day, it's the electors who will choose. So let's take in mind the last election that we had in 2016. It was heard a lot that one candidate won the popular vote, but the other one won the electoral college or the electoral vote. That meant that while one candidate was voted for by the people, at the end of the day, the elector voters, which is 270, how many they need, they did not go with the popular vote. They went with the other vote, which is very rare. It's only been seen 5 times. So really, when you're voting pretty much asking the Electoral College or the electors to please vote for that person that you elected. And in total, there's 538 electoral votes with 270 needed to win the presidential election. So, as mentioned, although every elected official in the U.S., from school committees and members to the U.S. to state senators, are elected based on popular vote, the president and vice president are elected by the Electoral College. Use that knowledge we all mentioned in the beginning and start discussing it. And I think the really big thing and the really important thing with everything we discussed is to discuss, why are most people not voting? Not only in this election have we heard it a lot, but we've heard it a lot in previous elections where the person that they wanted for Democratic nominee or Republican nominee didn't win. So they're just like, I'm not going to vote for anyone. And I think that's a thought that we've all had. Why aren't people voting? And if it weren't for me, I would say that we are living in a very divisive time where I think people are not happy with policies, with all the policies, and feel that if they're not happy with the whole candidate in itself, they won't vote. That's my thought. I don't know, Brandon, Shamira, what do you guys think? So what would you guys say is the reason or thought that people are not voting? Because I think we've all heard that.
I can agree with you in a sense that that is a reason why a lot of people don't vote, is because they feel like their voices aren't being heard. And in a sense, like if you kind of reflect back to 2016, specifically with Bernie Bros, they felt like they were disenfranchised, that Bernie had this momentum and then somehow a specific part of the convention just kind of like ixnayed him out. And then it was just like, well, this is your candidate, and this is, you know, we have to all back this one person, this one candidate. But I feel like in order for everyone to kind of feel heard, the political heads of each party, whoever's like winning, I think they should at least place everyone, like someone that has different backgrounds and different policies within their administration. So then everyone feels like somewhere, I may not have the person that I want to be president, but at least someone in their government is reflecting some of the ideals and values that I have. And I think that people will feel a little more united, you know, going forward.
Yeah, I would agree. For sure, with that. Trust, I think, is one of the biggest things people are having difficulty is trusting the government again, especially after all the things that have happened in the last 4 years. I think that's just created more mistrust. And it's in particular, not with just, it's all across the board. I think some ages are being more affected in regards to the trust. Like younger people, I do think younger people are being swayed away from politics, because that mistrust is just growing so much from the government to the people.
Yeah, I think you guys both made some really good points there. And I think just to add to the conversation, I think there is also a component, another component at play here, where people really feel like they're not, their voices aren't really being heard almost. I mean, if you look at the election season from 2016, you'll see that, like, you know, Hillary, she won the popular vote, but she didn't necessarily win the Electoral College, right? So, you know, you could tell who the public wanted to win, but that wasn't necessarily the outcome. So I think that's another reason why people might feel like, why even bother voting, right? That might be a part of that conversation of understanding how voting works and why it works the way that it works. And do you really feel like you're being totally represented in who you're actually voting for? So I think that is a big part of, I think, the problem too, is that, you know, do you really feel like your voice is being heard based on who you're voting for and who wins, even? Because whoever wins, you know, just, you know, you didn't necessarily vote for them, and they may not have policies that you really feel like you're putting, you know, that is where your heart is. So I think that's a part of it too. So And I think a good point might be to make here is that way back when people used to run for president and vice president, whoever didn't win presidency would actually become the vice president. So that was an interesting little tidbit that I found out and I thought was very interesting, because even if you watch Hamilton, you'll see that, like, you know, Thomas Jefferson was running, and he was running against, you know, whoever, James Madison or something. And then James Madison became vice president or something like that. So I think that I don't know why they got rid of that really, but, and maybe Brandon has a little bit more insight, but I thought that was really interesting, because, you know, why is that not a thing now? Why do we not take whoever ran against, you know, the two people who ran against each other, and we make the other one vice president? And why can't they just be together? I mean, they both wanted to do, you know, they both wanted to make a change. So why are we not going with that? So it's another good question I had.
Yeah. And honestly, I really don't know why they stopped doing it, but I thought that was an interesting fact as well, because, you know, in current elections, it's more of like the Democrat or Republican wins, they pick their VP, and that's who you have for 4 years. And then if they happen to win again, you get another term. But to kind of like add more to the conversation, I think another reason why most people don't vote is that if you reflect on every election, the same topics are brought up. And then if you sit back and reflect on these topics such as immigration, healthcare, student loan debt, those things never seem to go away, right? It's every 4 years you hear like, oh, we're going to fix healthcare, we're going to fix immigration, we're going to fix this burden on the millennials, the student loan debt, and it never gets fixed. So to a lot of people, it's like, why continue to vote for these people that say that they're going to make change and then there is no change, you know?
Yeah, so lackluster changes.
Exactly.
Promises, empty promises a little bit. So yeah, I see that point.
Yeah,
but I think we made a good point of what the importance of voting is, right? Because then people put policies into place that may not align with what's best for your life. So, I mean, the importance of voting is that, you know, someone else might get into office and they may take, I don't want to say take some of your rights away, but they may take away some of the things that are going to better your life. So, you know, a lot of the times I think we have to think about also maintaining, voting for the person who we know is going to maintain what we already have.
But
and that's a reality for a lot of minorities and immigrants, I think.
I think, though, you've sort of, okay, so you've mentioned voting, correct? You mentioned voting, how it's important to elect the people that we want in office, so the policies that we want will stay in place or would be created. But I think that's the same reason they actually don't vote. That's the same reason they don't vote, because they're saying that they're feeling that their vote is worthless. That even though they voted, their popular vote went to Clinton, but the Electoral College won. So then they're like, why vote? And then I think now seeing sort of, even for me, I was sort of shocked, quite honestly. I mean, I did my thesis on policy and politics, but for me, when I learned about the Electoral College, I was pretty shocked, and I was like, well, why am I gonna vote if, yeah, it was only the fifth time, but what if it becomes a trend? What if it becomes a trend that, okay, well, the Electoral College will just do whatever they're gonna do? I mean, nowadays, you hear everybody say, well, they're gonna pay them off, and then they're gonna vote, and they're gonna give them money. Like, it's the same reason I think that people should vote is the same reason they're not voting, because they feel that their vote is worthless. But I think we have to take a step back and sort of see the beauty of politics, which many people do not think there's any beauty in politics. But I think the beauty in politics is that it gives you a voice. While it may not sound like it, you have a voice by voting, and maybe voting is not enough, but you have the opportunity to go higher, to create campaigns. Now with social media, we've saw the campaign of Vanessa Guillen, who was murdered by an army commander, and that came to light, and the whole issue came to light because social media and the mom and the family were like just repeating it, sharing it over and over again until people got tired and were like, what in the world is this? And the same thing is happening right now with the campaign Save Your Children, or Save the Children, with child pedophilia and everything else that's going on. So I think the beauty of politics is that people can get more involved and people can raise their voice and show that something is an issue. And but sometimes that's another thing too. You got to take in mind politics can be sort of like a war, and you have to have enough members on your team and enough people vouching for you, and you have to know where you want to take it. So for example, walks. I believe walking, taking walks like the Women's March and protest, they work, but they work only to a certain extent. We need to take the jump forward. And if we see that voting, we're not trusting voting, or we don't like it, whatever, for whatever reason, because of 2016, then we need to take another step forward. And we need to go to our state senators, to our local offices, to DC, wherever we want to go. A lot of people don't know, but in Arizona, for example, we have an open committee, an open chamber. So if you want to go testify for a bill in the state that you disagree with, you can go do that. So I think we really need to learn that voting is not the only way. And if you feel that your vote is not heard, well, guess what? You have the opportunity to make yourself heard. You just got to take that one step forward. And I think, unfortunately, right now, with how all the politics are, we need to take that one step forward. We need to not just vote, but we need to get involved in politics. We need to protest and walk, but we also need to go and impact that policy change, whether it's in our state level or our federal government.
What I'm hearing is plan, mobilize, and action.
Yes.
And to add to that again, I feel like we also need to hold the politicians that we elect accountable, right? Because even currently, you know, like right now we are in the midst of a pandemic, right? And our congressmen and women, they are at home during recess, and then you still have some people that are at home and they don't have unemployment, they don't have a job, and they're waiting, they're looking for the government to provide them some assistance, and they're not getting any. And to even look towards California, for example, they have this bill called Proposition 16, where they're trying to overturn a bill that was passed years ago that stopped discriminatory housing. So essentially, if Proposition 16 passes, then businesses, landlords, they can discriminate to who they rent or send out loans to.
Wait, what? I did not know this. This is so interesting.
Proposition 16.
Yep, and I think that brings us sort of to the how some of the issues that affect even minority voting, because you're looking at it and it's just like, well, the whole government's against me. Why am I going to vote?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there are also other barriers to it that at the state level they implement, and it's actually really sad because you hear it every election season that in certain areas, let's say of Miami or Nashville or something, or they'll, you know, put one voting booth in that area to serve, you know, one voting location in that area to serve like X amount of people, and everyone just won't get a chance to vote. And it's quite sad to see that. Or people will get turned away at the door because they're not on the list. That happens often, right, Brandon? I think, you know, that happens every election season. I mean, it's just interesting because I feel like we deal with the same issues every 4 years. And I think at this point we should be trying to find a different way to do things, or at least not even a workaround, but really trying to change the way we do politics. I mean, you have to understand that like both parties go after the same people. They go after the minority vote, Black, Brown, Hispanics. They go to all the Black and Brown people, right? So I think it's important to understand that like when you're blocking votes of Black and Brown people, you are targeting a specific type of people, right? Because you don't want their voices to be heard for whatever reason. So I think that is probably my point, is that every election season we talk about the same things, that Black and Brown people are blocked from voting, in a lot of different locations across the United States. And that's something that we should be focusing on and paying attention to.
Right. And I think that kind of leads into the mail-in voting, right? That's a big topic right now. And I think that's why you do see some resistance in it, because with mail-in voting, it kind of prevents that, it prevents the barring of, you know, preventing people from to vote, because it's being sent through mail. Unless your mail person's not delivering your mail ballot, there's no way for them to kind of disenfranchise that voter, right?
Yeah, but I think we need to keep in mind that when it comes to mail-in voting, there's been studies, political studies, there's been a lot of those things where we can see that there is a margin of error. And of course, I think there's more things that can go wrong versus going to a polling station, but it's still effective and it's still one that worked, but by far it has a lot of more obstacles that we need to tackle. And right now we're seeing it right now, the USPS, it's voting has become a political issue. And just like COVID has become political, everything's a political issue. It's become a political issue because now they don't want to fund, or they want to defund, Trump wants to defund USPS, which is impacting a lot of people, because that's what you do, right? You get it in the mail, you vote, and then you give it back, and they take it where they have to. That's how majority of people use their mail-in voting. But now with that, it's sort of like, well, you've created a huge, huge obstacle for us to get our ballots in. Now, I think regarding the second point regarding politics, that we have to change politics, I'm not sure if we can change politics. I think we can change the people, because politics is like a toolkit, sort of. It's like, it's strategizing. It's doing strategies and figuring out who to go first to, so in order this can get passed. Or it, politics is everywhere. It's in academia. It's in a lot of places. So I think really it's figuring out, not so much changing the politics, but getting people that will use those tools well. I don't think right now.
But I do feel that the reason why I said change politics is because a lot of new people who come in are learning politics from people who are higher up, who've been there for years. So that information is trickling down from senior representatives who have been there for a really long time. So it's almost like keeping the same cycle going, almost. And I think that it really starts with people. It's a change management mindset, right? So it's changing the way that you're thinking about politics. And I don't necessarily think changing the people will work, because like I said, new people do come in. You know, you see these younger politicians coming in, but nothing's really changing because this is the system and they're learning it from the other people who are within that system already.
I would not say that's particularly the reason. I would say that there's a lot of fresh new politicians that are coming, or lawmakers more so that are coming. But when you have a majority, which is when there is more of one party than the other, the majority party or minority party, when you have more of one than the other, you don't have enough people with you in order for your political toolkit to work. So that's the thing too. I think we need more term limits, in my opinion, because I do agree that that's true. We have all these senior officials teaching them how to navigate the world of politics, but they're teaching them all the same. Right. So that's true. I do believe we need new people. We need term limits. I know people that have been senators, U.S. senators, for like 30 years.
I totally agree. Term limits, but then that means they would have to write the law to limit themselves to actually only yes. have a certain amount of terms. So the likelihood of that happening is very slim.
Yeah, it's slim.
But I totally agree, because think about, you know, like AOC and Omar and Rashida Tlaib. Like, those are new, fresh faces in Congress.
That all got reelected.
Right. And you know, they can only do but so much because they're freshman congressmen and women, right?
Mm-hmm. So, and I think that takes us back to sort of the voting in regards to sort of your state and local levels too, is that it all connects. All the government sort of connects. And so you voted, for example, I'll take a step back. For example, in Arizona, you have a lot of U.S. state House of Representatives, particularly, that have no competition. So they don't run a campaign, essentially, because they don't have people to compete with, to campaign against with. So that's another thing, too, is that that's why you're seeing that so many of the same people, is because we need more people in politics to come and try to change things, like AOC, like Omar, all of them. They're four of the greatest, in my view and in my sense, lawmakers that are out there that represent the community as a whole. But you have all of these other that have been there for 30 plus years that just they won't allow them to pass any other laws, even if they tried their best, because the political human capital is not there. Because politics is like a toolkit, and if you don't have the political human capital, you won't pass laws. And that's what's happening right now.
That money, and that's why Yeah, and that's why I think, you know, when, I think it was Elizabeth Warren, when she was like, we need to pass a bill to get money out of politics. And I feel like that's a great idea, because money kind of rules politics. And if you don't have the money, you really don't even have a fair share into even getting started. I think that is what kind of makes AOC, like, she stood out, is because you had this bartender that really didn't have any money.
Mm-hmm.
She made it, you know?
Yep. And it's true. I mean, sometimes even when you want to run a campaign, it's just so much money. Not only is the campaign so much money, but then there's donors. Then you get to the political human capital, where there's donors. And then, well, if that candidate gives me more money, then I'll vote for you. And you have all these political, that's where the political chess game happens. And it's tough. And I do believe that we need term limits, and we need to limit the money in politics that goes around in politics.
Mm-hmm.
But any final thoughts on that, or do we want to move on to the good news story?
Well, I guess before we end, the difference between mail-in voting and absentee voting. Just to clear the air, because, you know, you hear so many conflicting stories lately because of our president. but, you know, mail-in voting and absentee voting is essentially the same thing. The only difference is that certain states, depending on the laws, you have to register for it with information that they ask you for. You submit it, and then they send you the ballot. Where mail-in voting is just that if you're already registered, you're going to send it out to your last address that you were registered at.
I think that's really good information, because a lot of people were confused, and some people actually started saying the idea of, why don't you just send in ballots to people to vote? But that is essentially what mail-in voting is. If you're registered, they'll send you something.
Right. And then, you know, back to that, the argument about the USPS service, like funding and stuff, there are drop boxes where you can, you know, take your ballot instead of, you know, mailing it from home. So where they'll just pick it up from there, it's just a matter of you navigating in your county to find out where those drop boxes are.
Well, then moving on to the good news story. So who wants to say their good news story first?
Since I'm the guest, I'll go. So I'll start off with Sir Captain Tom Moore in England. He walked 100 miles and raised $100,000 for the Salvation Army. He surpassed his original goal of 5,000, and he raised that 100K.
Wow.
Mind you, he's 100 years old himself.
That is great news.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
I hope I have that stamina when I get that age.
I think we all hope for that. Okay, so I think I'll go next. So my good news story is about a kindergarten teacher who turned desks in her classroom into trucks to make social distancing measures fun for students. So this kindergarten teacher was from Texas, and she realized that social distancing measures were going to be difficult for children in her classroom. So she wanted to cheer them up by turning desks into trucks, even making the required desk shields look like windshields. And I thought that it was just such a thoughtful story. And I thought it was really cute, because I think when you think about trying to social distance kids, I think that can be really tough. And so trying to get kids back into the classroom while also social distancing, you know, I think this is like a fun way to keep them sort of, keep their minds sort of, and even their spirits high in the classroom while trying to also social distance and not be so close to their friends. So I thought this was such a cute story, and yeah, I wanted to share it here.
So I have one more good story, which I found very interesting and scientific, was that in Australia, so millions of gallons of beer that expired during lockdown in Australia were converted into renewable energy that powered 1,200 homes, which I thought was a great way to use alcohol. So that was pretty, pretty good.
That is a great way to use alcohol, I must admit.
Right?
I love that story. So thanks for joining us, and make sure to follow us on Twitter at whatsupph, or drop us a line at whatsuppublichealth@gmail.com if you have any topics you would like for us to cover. Please don't forget to leave us a 5-star rating wherever you listen to us. Until next time.